It's
obviously ideal situation that we are talking about. Yes. Obviously, the ideal situation, infallible imam should be there, who is in occultation.
Okay.
But in his absence, in his occultation, obviously, we need someone who looks like him. And if we don't have, obviously, why we are emphasizing that we need someone? Because if someone comes like this, he can change the system.
Okay.
Because we do not have such people, that's why we do not see any change in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why in the upper hand, we can see like injustice, and in the lower hand, the people are trying to bring justice.
Yes.
And the TV shows that you refer to, like when they bring some poor people and they're giving these things, they're forgetting that there are thousands or millions of people out there who needs the same check. You just showed one person on the TV and... Even justice. This is not fair, even.
Okay.
What about them?
Okay.
This is who you get to, obviously. So we need to find out, like, different ways to help people. And obviously, why Quran and why in the verses, obviously, it is referred to the qist as well. Because there's a difference between adl and qist.
That's right.
Adl is far beyond qist. Qist is part of adl. In the qist, obviously, it has come from the division. And it said, a division on the basis of justice is called qist. Why it is said, why in the Quran Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has used both terms is because they use the word qist so that when you're doing division, when you're dividing the resources, when you're doing dividing the, you can say like the money for the orphans.
The public funds.
Yes, anything that you have,
okay.
You should apply qist. Mm-hmm. This is part of just.
Yeah.
And the opposite word for the qist is obviously discrimination.
That's right.
When you have discrimination while you're distributing or dividing the resources or the money, because I said qist is related to the monetary terms or division, numbering.
Yes.
So when you're not dividing on the basis of justice, it will be discrimination.
Okay.
It is not qist.
That's all right. Thank you very much. Dr. Azadeh and Said Mohsen Naqvi, for your presence in the program. The teacher, it was very kind of you. We'll continue our discussion regarding the concept of adl or justice and also qist in upcoming session of the program. But do not forget to visit our website, dear listeners, as parstoday.com/Ian Khalaf Islam page. Also, YouTube channel, Khalaf Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Tehran. The country is on the edge of a precipice. Street clashes are raging between the army and the people. Endless strikes are crippling the country. Prime ministers are being ousted one after another, and foreign nationals leaving the country. The Shah is helpless. The Shah is hopeless. Nothing can assuage the anger of the nation. A revolution is in sight. October 24, 1978. Tehran, the glass prison. A few months before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, a great number of political prisoners are released after years of being in prison and under torture. Since the beginning of the Pahlavi dynasty, the glass prison had been the graveyard of many political opponents. But within a few months, it would fall into the hands of revolutionaries, and a new chapter in the history of this edifice would begin. The name of this prison still conjures up images of many contemporary Iranian figures that fought heart and soul against the Pahlavi regime. The Ghass Prison. Over the last two centuries, this building has undergone many fundamental changes, each one mirroring part of this land's history. The Glass Edifice.
Part 2.
Tehran, the Ghasr Garden Museum. In 2001, the Ghasr prison was closed down after 76 years. In a 10-year project, the municipality of Tehran converted it into the Ghasr Garden Museum. The museum has three main parts: the Markov prison, the political prison, and a large garden the prisons are located in. In the Garden Museum, exhibition stands have been set up, each one representing a critical moment in the history of Iran. A number of political prisoners during the Pahlavi era are here to recount their first-hand experiences for visitors. The building is located in the center of Tehran, but around 200 years ago, during the Qajar dynasty, it was miles away from the city, in a district known as Khurram Abad Hills. In 1798, Fath Ali Shah, the second king of the Qajar dynasty, ordered a recreational palace to be built outside Tehran, a great palace that cost the court dearly. When Reza Shah came to the throne, the country's penal system needed a complete overhaul. The number of prisoners was growing and the old prisons no longer met international standards. The government had to establish modern prisons and recognize civil rights for its convicts. In the opening ceremony, Brigadier Dargahi was showing the new prison to Reza Shah and other high-ranking officials. When the group reached the iron cell, the brigadier opened the door for the Shah and asked him and his entourage to step in. But the Shah refused to enter when he was warned by his court minister of a possible coup d'etat. 2 days later, Brigadier Dargahi was relieved of his command and became the first prisoner of this macabre prison. After the events of June 1963, led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, SAVAK, an intelligence agency, turned into a secret police to crush any signs of revolt, and the Iron Fist became the signature of this fearsome organization. Habeas corpus was no longer a right for all people, and forced confessions and long detentions became SAVAK's repeat prescription for any political dissident.
از سال 50 رژیم شاه برخوردش با زندانیان سیاسی بسیار خشن خصمانه.
From the year 1971, the Pahlavi regime treated political prisoners very brutally and revengefully. Before that, they would treat a political prisoner like a bankrupt in a very ordinary way. But from 1971 on, they were facing people they considered as their sworn enemies who intended to overthrow the regime. The treatment was so brutal that they thought no one would dare go this way, or that prisoners would never resume their activities after being released.
Inside prisons, clerics would shoulder a special burden to teach young prisoners and broaden their horizons.
Prominent religious scholars like Ayatollah Taleghani and others tried to attract other people rather than to reject them. Even a person who had caved in a little to SAVAK torture would get ablaze when associated with such great people.
SAVAK, long suspicious of clerics' activities in prisons and afraid of their success, began to hold them back.
Up to the year 1974, the circumstances were desirable for political prisoners because there was no separation between them. For example, Mr. Taleghani and other prominent figures were all in the same prison, with a young man sentenced to a few months for distributing communiques. Such a man would mix with them and get trained by them. The political prison had become the University of the Revolution. But after the year 1974, most of the religious scholars were transferred to Evin Penitentiary, to a place specifically for religious scholars in order to disconnect their relations with other prisons so as to prevent them from growing.
Identifying different political and ideological currents in prisons and sowing discord among prisoners were on the list of SAVAK's priorities. The main aim was to pit opposition leaders against one another, tarnish their reputations and drain them of power so they couldn't fight the regime.
SAVAK Savak itself would provoke prisoners to discuss with each other and pit them against each other. So it was probable that a problem would rise between those people, and the winner was Savak. So to avoid such a thing inside prison, the prisoners tried to keep their unity, saying, "We have a common enemy, and in front of this common enemy, we have to be united and must not provide Savak with excuses."
By arresting political dissidents, Savak aimed to quench the raging flames of the revolution. But since almost all political prisoners were transferred to Tehran, the prisons became a hive of political activity. The prisoners were filled in on the latest gossip, news, or instructions and announcements issued by Ayatollah Khomeini by their families, who would visit them from every corner of the nation.
The best point of this prison had to do with meetings. A long, narrow corridor, a wall about 1 meter in height, with rails and nettings, and a distance of 1 meter with officers in between.
Imagine such a large number of visitors who wanted to talk to prisoners all at the same time in 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, all of them wanted to talk and tell their things. How was it possible for them to do so in 10 minutes? That's while some prisoners and families had to exchange political information from inside and outside the prison.
Mr. Mansouri believes political prisoners have always been well informed about the country's affairs.
After all, political prisoners would try regularly to be up to date and have the best analysis of the issues. It may be interesting to know that we in prison knew much more about the country's issues than those who were outside prison. The reason was that, besides studying and discussing, those families who came to see their children would give them information from all over the country, and this information would come into prison.
Drunk with absolute power, the Shah of Iran gave Savak more leeway to oppress any opposition. No matter how hard political parties struggled, the prospect looked grim. From 1975, Savak stopped releasing political prisoners, even after serving their sentences.
At that time, freedom had no meaning for the political prisoner, even for a person who had finished his term in prison. There are many examples of this case who had finished their terms in prison in 1977, but they were not released from prison.
One week before their release, they would be transferred to Evin Penitentiary, and on their release days, they were forced to sign their detention papers. After serving their time, their families were waiting for them on their release days. They would be counting the days for their release. But not only were they not released on the day, but also they were given a detention paper to sign and held in Evin Penitentiary. What's the significance of Evin? In Evin, there was no visit. The families lost touch with the prisoners again.
In those days, the Shah was the cruelest dictator in the Middle East, and reports on human rights in Iran were disappointing. But since the US didn't put pressure on its Iranian ally, the Shah never admitted the deplorable conditions in his country.
You're saying you do what every country does?
Sure.
If torture is necessary, you torture.
Not the torture in the old sense of torturing people, twisting their arms and doing this and that. But there are intelligent ways of questioning now.
Well, they talk about psychological and physical torture.
Physical, I don't believe.
I talked
not anymore. Maybe in the old days, maybe.
I talked just today to a man whom I believe who told about torture.
He was tortured?
Yes.
And you believe that he was tortured?
Yes.
How many years ago?
Within, I want to be very careful, not yesterday.
Ah, well, maybe. I don't know.
The word has gone out to stop it.
To stop what?
Torture.
But a long time ago, yes.
Until 1976, the Shah was a despot, a ruthless man with everything at his disposal. Above all, the country's wealth. That year, the Republicans in the US stepped down from power. The Shah had spent the country's petrodollars on his favorite candidate, Gerald Ford. But in the end, the young Jimmy Carter, with his slogan of human rights, was sworn in as the new president of the United States.
To human rights must be absolute. But let no one confuse our idealism with weakness. Because we are free, we can never be indifferent to the fate of freedom elsewhere.
در جریان انتخابات ریاست جمهوری امریکا
During the U.S. presidential elections, in order to earn a domestic and international reputation, the Democratic nominee announced his decision over abiding by human rights because his predecessors didn't do that at all. They were Republican, abrasive, belligerent, and suppressive. When they came to power, they asked all the dictators who were U.S. pawns to open political space and improve the image of the U.S.
The Shah of Iran made a U-turn on political freedom and an attempt to win favor with the new U.S. president. As a result, the Savak's harassment reduced and political activities increased.
قرار شد مجامع بین المللی مثل صلیب سرخ جهانی
It was decided that international organizations like the Red Crescent, Amnesty International, the Human Rights Organization, to visit the country's prisons, the political prisons. The Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee had a torture chamber. They quickly put some shelves in the torture chamber and converted it into a library. They put the books they had taken from us there to tell the international organizations that they had a library in the prison.
With this democratic gesture, the Shah aimed to ameliorate the situation and persuade the White House to sell him arms. Both Carter and the Shah rested assured that with the Savak and the most powerful army in the region, an open political space would never put the regime in danger.
در مجلس سنای امریکا از وزیر خارجه
The U.S. Senate had asked the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Cyrus Vance, Mr. Vance, if political freedom in Iran leads to the downfall of the Shah, you will be held responsible. Vance said that they would abide by human rights as far as U.S. national interests were safe.
In the end, opening a political space, rather than diffusing the situation, helped the opponents hold demonstrations, deliver speeches, and attack Savak for its crimes on an unprecedented scale.
در هر حال این اتفاق افتاد و وقتی که به قضایای سالهای 56 اینا رسیدن
Anyway, as they faced the events in 1977 and 1978, they found out that they couldn't do anything because they had done anything possible without being successful. They agreed to have an open political space since the U.S. had asked them. They were to hold a free election and form a national government, but in reality, from early 1979, they lost control and could do nothing, although Jimmy Carter called the Shah several times, allowing him to do anything to control the situation, and assured the Shah of his support. In other words, Carter said what Cyrus Vance had said before, The U.S. didn't want the Shah to fall, but to improve the situation a little bit.
In 1979, These changes improved the situation for political prisoners, and old lags on small charges were released.
Since SAVAK had lost its support, it was forced to release many prisoners, those who had finished their terms and those who were in prison for very simple unarmed activities.
On October the 24th, 1978, 1,126 political prisoners were released. Among them was Safar Qahramani, one who had been in different prisons for about 30 years. By releasing these prisoners, most of them on minor charges like reading forbidden books, the regime wanted to control public indignation. The newly released prisoners went to Behesht-e Zahra Cemetery to pay homage to those who lost their lives fighting for freedom. They said they owed their freedom to public support, not the false benevolence of the regime. In January 1979, the Shah left Iran under the pretext of receiving medical treatment. Weeks later, Imam Khomeini returned to Iran after 15 years of exile. His arrival gave the nation a new lease of life. Within a short space of time, the people took control of all military and strategic centers, including the Qasr prison, and released all political prisoners. A number of army top brass and SAVAK agents were arrested and put in the prison for a while. The first trials to investigate their crimes were held in the mosque of this prison. After the 1979 revolution, the Qasr prison was converted into an ordinary prison. But since it was located inside the residential district, in 2001 it was closed down forever. The municipality of Tehran then reconstructed the building and turned it into a museum. A museum that embodies the 200-year history of modern Iran.
During the time I was in the political department of the Garden Museum, I saw the youth we talked to change their opinions completely at the end of their visit. They couldn't believe that in Iran, under the Shah, such things existed. The society must be informed about it. The world must be informed about it.
For me, these things must be etched on the walls of the Qasr prison. Here is the mirror reflecting the downfall of cruelty and corruption.
The Qasr Garden Museum in the heart of Tehran, a place that would once send shivers up and down spines, has now become a favourite haunt for people.
Most of the visitors who come here have a critical attitude, but when they're leaving here, they are overwhelmed and express their kindness to us. When it's explained for them, they realize what had happened here and who had to bear what harms and sufferings.
With its many programs and shows, the museum magnetizes a variety of visitors from friends and families to school students and tourists.
In my opinion, the Qasr Garden Museum is a national place, and its programs must be national and distinguished, and even have a look at international programs. I believe that these bricks in this space are alive with the breaths of people. They must come and go if we want this place to be alive. When you enter Qasr Garden Museum, we see a pleasant place. That's due to the breaths of families who come here willingly.
A palace, a prison, and now a museum. a witness to the pain and grief of many people, this edifice has many stories to tell the children of this ancient land.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Talk about the laws of copyright according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwa. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javed, since we are talking about the laws related to copyright according to Ayatollah Khamenei, let me ask you this question, which is somehow prevalent in many countries. You know, there are lots of offices and organizations, especially the governmental institutions,
yes,
that require you to give them some photocopies. And sometimes, you know, you go to a photocopier, you ask them to photocopy, for example, some materials for you on the pretext that they can be of benefit, in fact, to the believers or to the duty-bound or basically to the clients here.
Yes.
Without the permission of the owner of the content to be printed or photocopied. So would the ruling be different if the owner of the photocopier knew that the owner of the printed material or matter would object to people photocopying it?
Well, I think this is nothing less than violating or breaching the copyright law. I think this is just a change in the example. Otherwise, when we look at it very closely,
mm-hmm.
we understand that it's something like a book that is being published or reprinted. It's just like an article that you write, and I, for example, someone else prints or reprints it and reproduces it and publishes it and makes use of it. Or maybe gives it to someone else to use it. So it's just a different example. And Ayatollah Khamenei has, again, I would say that he says that as a measure of precaution, he should not take that initiative to photocopy that material without the permission of the owner. So he who wants to photocopy or photostate or duplicate that thing, he has to obtain the original writer's or author's permission, and then he can take action to photocopy the material. Otherwise, it's not permissible as an obligatory precaution.
No, it's not.
It's not, yes.
Uh-huh, I see. Okay. Another question is also very common, that there are lots of video shops that rent videotapes or even cassettes to their customers. And if, some believers, for example, rent some videos and after watching them, they like it.
Good.
And they like to, in fact, duplicate it or make a copy of it and have it for themselves to put it in their, reservoir of videos, for example, that they are keeping for themselves without the permission of the shopkeeper.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Yes.
Is that permissible, first of all? And assuming that they do that because they think, sort of think, that most of the religious authorities and mujtahids,
yes,
do not really believe in the copyright. So they are under this assumption that the mujtahids do not recognize the copyright, so they do it. They make a copy of it without the permission of the shopkeeper. Are such people justified in what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
First of all? And assuming it is not permissible according to
the Islamic laws, you know, should they hurry to seek the permission of the owner of the tape or the shopkeeper, or simply deleting the content is enough?
Well, some videos, let's say, let's discuss it a bit more broadly. Some videos are so commonplace, okay? They are not copyrighted, and they are not protected by the law. The logo, which maybe says that it is protected, but it's so old. The video is so old that it's no longer. It does not any longer have any, let's say,
copyright.
Any copyright. The copyright could be let's say, limited. For example, for the year 2020, okay, but it's not copyrighted for the year 2021, okay, or 23 in the following years. So, if that is the case, you don't need to ask permission of the, let's say, of the shop or the video club, and you can copy it, use it, or maybe you can duplicate it. That's something. But if it is indeed protected by the law, and the copyright clearly states that you don't have the right to copy it for the year, let's say, 2020, then in that case, Ayatollah Khamenei says that as a measure of precaution, one should not copy a video without the permission of the owner. One has to consult the owner, seek his permission, or seek his representative's permission, or the permission of that company which has produced it. Okay, because in modern time, it's not an individual who produces a video. A video is produced by a company, let's say Bollywood, Hollywood, and these are the companies, very well-known international companies. And also every country has its own publishing company or composing companies. And these companies has to be, the permission has to be obtained from these companies in order for the individual to be able to copy it. To his hard disk. Otherwise, it's not permissible as a measure of precaution. As I said, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei exercises precaution in most of these cases, of the examples that you gave, the instances. And if there is, if you doubt whether there is permission or not, again, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, you have to exercise precaution, because precaution is the best policy if you want to be on the safe side.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you just said that, is it permissible if you have downloaded the file, the video file is in your hard disk, you want to, you have done something which you should not have done. Now, can you just simply delete it and are you absolved of this obligation or the wrong that you have committed? Of course, His Eminence says that it is sufficient to delete or to wipe the recorded material off the tape, and there is no problem in that. Now, imagine you can, for example, we are talking about videotape. If there is anything else, if there is, let's say, for example, an audio file, mm-hmm. you have copied, even if that audio file is a religious lecture, a religious, let's say, eulogy, mm-hmm. which is copyrighted, and it's in your hard disk, you want to listen to it, thinking that since it's a religious file or a religious lecture, the lecturer himself or maybe the publishing company might not, let's say, forbid anyone from downloading or listening to it, because it's in the large, in the best interest of the people, of the special Muslim people, to listen and to be guided, to enrich their knowledge and to improve their understanding and perception of religious teachings and religious doctrines. So this assumption could be there, but this assumption does not mean that one should go ahead and copy and copy these yes. these files. So, based on the fatwa of His Eminence, it is safer, it is better, and to exercise precaution and to delete this file if someone has copied yes. them and has downloaded them or maybe copied them into his hard disk. And this is the answer given by Ayatollah Khamenei.
Thank you very much, Sheikh.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illa hum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
This type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd al-Salam.
Allah. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته and welcome to IRIB English Radio, dear listeners and for humanity, where we are discussing in this program the treaties of rights of Imam As-Sajjad Zain al-Abidin, peace be upon him. We're talking about the rights of the adversary, someone who has a claim against you. In Islam, we don't believe in conflict. We try to neutralize the situation when it does come to someone having any kind of hostility towards you. And this is exactly what Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, is trying to teach us here in this particular segment of Risalatul Huquq. He's saying to us, you know, don't let things get to court. Don't allow things to turn into strong conflict between two sides. You know, try to use reason, try to use religion, try to use morals, you know, and don't lose all of this sentimental, these sentimental values that you have. Because, you know, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. And that's why Imam As-Sajjad, after he says, وَكَسَرْتَ حِدَّتُهُ عَنْكَ بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ, when you try to neutralize their hostility towards you by making them remember Almighty God, he then says, وَأَلْقَيْتَ حَشْوَ الْكَلَامِ وَلَفْضَهُ الَّذِي لَا يَرُدُّ عَنْكَ عَادِيَةَ عَدُوِّكَ. And that basically it means after you remind them of God, you are also going to be helping them reduce their fury against you. Why? By avoiding using any kind of indecent words or any kind of statements that are going to aggravate the person. You know, you're going to avoid any kind of superfluous and irrelevant talk or bad talk, because this kind of talk, la yaruddu anka adiyata aduwik, this kind of talk, when you're going to be saying bad things, when you're going to use indecent words, right? This kind of approach is going to make your opponent, is going to make your adversary even more aggravated. They're going to have more enmity and hatred and hostility towards you. Because, of course, this is the natural way of how it's going to happen. وَأَلْقَيْتَ حَشْوَ الْكَلَامِ وَلَغَطَهُ الَّذِي لَا يَرُدُّ عَنْكَ عَادِيَةَ عَدُوُّكَ. So you're going to avoid superfluous and irrelevant talk. لَغَط means irrelevant talk, because such talk cannot remove the enmity of your adversary, of your or the person who is making a claim against you. It's not going to have any effect. Anything that you say that's extra, that's too much talk, that's irrelevant talk, you know, you have to tolerate this very much. And if a question is brought to court, make sure you check with your adversary, you check with your opponents. Because if you enter into the controversy, if you enter into this adversary, you are going to receive a lot of negative effects. There's going to be a lot of bad things that come out of this. And that's why the Holy Prophet ﷺ, he portrays a very beautiful landscape of how to deal with conflict between two sides, which left is the part of the man and the religion and wisdom, and the other side is the part of the world and society and the conscious and everything else. And none of this is going to become invalidated if this is dealt in this particular way. We're just going to go for a short break and we will be back very, very soon.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. And while we were talking about trying to neutralize the situation with your opponent, with minimizing the damage that a person might have with someone that they are in conflict with, it's always very, very important to realize that this level of hostility is not going to get us anywhere, because a wise person does not spill their tongue into conflict with other people and doesn't lose their precious time in trying to aggravate the situation. You know, the Imam, peace be upon him, he says this with a lot of passion, and he says you need to prevent yourself from taking any hostility against you, you know, by avoiding bad things that are being said. You know, someone is not going to be hostile towards you, and you will be the one that benefits from this. If you do say something irrelevant, you're going to benefit absolutely nothing, and there are going to be many, many disadvantages that come out of that. So if you open your tongue in vain and you try to refute the false claim that is being attributed against you, and you become agitated and you lose your temper, then not only are you going to regret for what it is that you are doing, but it might also lead to that enmity becoming deeper and deeper, and your adversary having more hostility towards you. Unfortunately, the root of many mischiefs, many fitnas and seditions, many bloodshed, many corruption, many murders, many usurpings and plundering, and all these other bad things when it comes to people and society and property and things like that, are based on one's misleading their talk and not being observant of what it is that they say. And the opposite person, the adversary, taking things in such a way where they reverse this and they have hostility. And good language is going to lead you to goodness. And saying something good is always going to lead to positivity as well, from your side and from the side of everyone else. Whereas, if you were to say something irrelevant or say something inappropriate, it's going to be the seeds for many evil and many sedition, and it's going to expand and expand and grow and grow. So it's better for you to speak good words and stay away from bad words and never abuse, and always try to respect and tolerate. And if you do so, you will be successful in the outcome of what it is that you need to get to, even though someone is making a false claim against you. We'll continue on speaking about this particular segment from Imam Ali's Sajjad's Risalatul Huquq. Until then, please visit us on parstoday.com, or you're able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. And until our next program on For Humanity, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa alin nabiyil azim. Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa alin nabiyil azim.
Inside Israel. The social crisis in Israel has become big, so big that it's now a national security threat. This is according to the annual strategic assessment of Israel, published by the National Security Research Institute at Tel Aviv University.
Well, we're coordinating with the leaders of the different cities, and we're making sure that we're in close contact. But of course,
We know there is a lot of tension due to the recent cabinet decisions, and a lot of people, especially in the religious cities such as, for example, Bnei Brak. As we saw yesterday, there were protests, and there are possibly protests that might take place also this evening. So that is something that we're definitely ready to deal with if necessary. But of course, the main aim will be to implement a full closure in all of the red zones, red cities.
The internal crisis in Israel now tops the third top post in the short list of national security threats facing Israel for the first time ever. In fact, it made the top list as the third most haunting issue for Israel, with Iran being on top place. This is the first time in Israel's history, apparently, that the social crisis there has been considered such a threat by the regime. It seems that things are only about to get worse there, too. According to the Institute, the internal crisis is represented by the instability of governance. The move to the fourth elections within 2 years would undermine the broad foundations of national security, the report added. The report also says that the crisis is a threat to Israel's national immunity. The report specifically cites the ongoing protests and the rise of violence and increase in bipartisan and divisions in Israeli politics that has reflected in society. The crisis, the report warns, will also lead to a weakening of regime agencies and institutions through difficulties in performance and obstruction of decision-making procedures. There is also a significant decrease in public confidence in institutions and the absence of solidarity and a common goal among the segments of Israeli society. The Institute believed that society is torn between health, economic, social, political, and governance crises simultaneously revealed during the corona epidemic. Keyword here, revealed. It turns out that these issues have always lingered in Israel, but were never addressed. The current crisis comes in light of the spread of the coronavirus as a result of the population's non-compliance with the instructions of the Ministry of Health and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It also comes after some officials failed to adhere to instructions such as total closure on the population. And when officials did finally adhere to the regime's rules, health officials said it was too late.
The decline in trust in institutions has two reasons. One is a long-range effect, and one is the short-term, which relates to the corona. The long-term is the attack on institutions, mainly by Netanyahu, over the last few years. The courts, the attorney general, the police, etc. Recently, the people who work, the civil servants who work at the Ministry of Finance. So the gatekeepers. I mean, if you attack these people and these attacks, look what happened in America with Trump attacking the media. Everybody is leftist. Everybody is subversive. So you can see the results in the decline of trust, and in the short term relates to the corona. The management of the corona crisis is pretty poor, and just look at so many people, both on the ultra-Orthodox communities and the Arab communities, who just defy the orders of the government. So all in all, the long term and the short term have a strong impact on the decline of trust in institutions. I think the statement by the INSS that the internal divisions and feuds are a national security and actually a national crisis is correct. We can deal with any external threat, and we've shown over the decades that whenever we are attacked, we get together and we prevail. If we are divided like this and we lose trust in the institutions, And we are getting into the fourth elections in 2 years. No wonder people lose trust, and when they lose trust,